Welcome to a special StarTrek.com audio commentary for Star Trek The Motion Picture, the Director's Edition. Today we are joined by three people whose extraordinary work on the Director's Edition effectively realized director Robert Wise's original vision of the film. Producer David C. Fine, Restoration Supervisor Michael Matesino, and Visual Effects Supervisor Darren R. Doctorman. Start playing the DVD now.
Hello and welcome to our commentary. My name is Mike Matesino. I was the restoration supervisor for the director's edition of Star Trek The Motion Picture, the director in question being Mr. Robert Wise, our dear friend, colleague, and mentor, who left us in September of 2005, shortly after his 91st birthday. May he rest in peace.
Indeed.
I am joined today by the two other gentlemen, without whom this project would not have been possible, and I will let them introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Dave Fine. I'm the producer of this little film, Star Trek The Motion Picture, the Director's Edition. I'm here with my good friends, and I'm sure Mr. Wise and Bob in spirit.
And this is Darren Doctorman, and I was the visual effects supervisor for this film. And I don't need to say the title of it again, because I think everyone knows what it is because they're watching it.
You think by now?
And I just wanted to say that we are from Television City in Hollywood. We are live on tape.
Yeah, so without further ado,
On tape? What's tape?
Yeah, what is tape? We'd like to thank our friends here at CBS who
Indeed.
Are on the other side of the glass recording this as we watch this
terrific
film. And we're listening to the marvelous musical overture by Jerry Goldsmith, who also left us in 2004. But he worked with us on this project. And it brings several things to mind. The first of which is that I think his only other musical overture, which was quite common in the 50s and 60s during the so-called Roadshow era, his only other one was on Bob Wise's film The Sand Pebbles, released in 1966. And I think, and my friends can correct me if I'm wrong, I think this film and Disney's The Black Hole, which opened 1 week later, were probably the last two films to theatrically open with this musical prelude.
I think that's right.
It was Black Hole at the time.
And it was a way of really, you know, stating that this was a big, important film. And there was a lot of publicity about Star Trek when it opened in December of 1979. The other thing that I'm reminded of is the sort of Robert Wise tradition of having something on screen while the overture plays, as opposed to traditional black leader. Because I think at the time West Side Story was done in 1961, there was a lot of word going around that theaters were cropping the overture off because they thought it was leader.
And a lot of the prints that we viewed had the overture chopped off as well, we noticed.
That's right.
It was great that Bob took the time to, you know, suggested that we do a star field. Mm-hmm. And it always felt like we were talking about it being either V'ger's journey or the Enterprise's journey back.
And we were going backwards, so we're sort of like that cliche of to see where you've been. This was the relaunch of Star Trek as a franchise for Paramount in 1979. After many years of development and the cancellation of the original television series 10 years earlier. And now we come to the credits, and boy, this just brings back a lot of things, too. Because one of you guys walked in one day with a fantastic objet d'art that I'll never forget. Which one of you was it?
Which one are you talking about?
Some black cards with white letters
on them.
Oh, yes.
The original titles when they were
title
found.
Cards.
And, the Woody Allen version.
Right. The black and white that they shot as
temps.
Yeah, so, as temps, and just had to cut it into the movie.
So there was some verisimilitude here because we used those actual things. We didn't just type this on a computer. We actually scanned those original title cards,
mm-hmm.
Correct?
That's correct.
And I don't know about you guys, but I'm remembering going to see this as a kid, and we knew, it was highly publicized that this film was extraordinarily expensive, over $40 million. We didn't know then that a good chunk of that had been spent on development. But mm-hmm. When you went to see this film and you saw those simple credits, you wondered, this does not feel like a big budget film, mainly because I remember that just a year before this opened, we had Superman, which was another hugely budgeted film. They don't even know how much it cost. And that had those spectacular animated credits, and you knew that the money was on the screen.
Well, I just remember when I first saw it that it didn't even occur to me that those were temp credits. I thought that was exactly what they meant to do, and that it was the way they wanted it. And
it was...
after realizing it, the first thing that I did on this project was actually re-render the main title logo and make it the one that appears now.
And I think we found storyboards of different versions for the titles when they were in the planning stages for this movie. And a lot of them, some of them were more elaborate than what we ultimately went with. And I think we, Bob agreed that we should try to not stray too far from what the movie was, but to fix what needed to be fixing. And we'll talk more about how that whole process evolved. But with specific regard to the credits, I do remember one other very funny story where we debated the color of them.
Well, there was a lot of talk about how the film was considered very cold in general, and there was some talk about going from the white logo, the white credits, to a blue, almost reminiscent of season 3 of the classic show.
Mm-hmm. And because most of this movie is lit blue, not this particular scene with the Klingon cruiser, but later on, everything associated with V'ger seems to be blue. The uniforms are very pale blue. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed consistent.
So it's funny that we actually brought, you know, Bob came in that day and we were saying, okay, well, here's the credits in blue. And we were showing him the whole thing. And he was saying, well, what other options do we have? And it's nice that inverting blue gives a goldish color. So it's pretty simple for us to just invert the coloring scheme. And he really liked the gold look to it. And that kind of gave us a whole feeling of, in general, we wanted to stick to this gold motif for this version of the film. And I think his exact words was let's go with the gold. It has balls.
At which point we all hit the floor.
Yeah, because, like, Bob?
Bob was an incredible gentleman and worked in this industry for 60 years and never ceased to be a gentleman, which is why he was a mentor and an inspiration to so many people. And to suddenly hear him just come out and say that, which was absolutely true. You know, and in retrospect, as I look at it, he was absolutely right. And he knew his stuff. And
it touches me that one little decision that he made, and he said it so strongly, gave us the, you know, the gold packaging, the gold logo is just gorgeous, and it just stuck to the project. And it was a very big conscious decision when we started with the project, was to warm the whole thing up with all the mechanical voices and, you know, the whole coldness of the film. Left you know, people with that feeling as well, and just the premise of going with the gold and having it be warm from the beginning helped dramatically.
And even the color timing, which we participated in near the beginning of the project, was focused on making everything less gray than it had appeared in previous transfers.
And that was mainly the transfers, because the film didn't look like that.
No, the film was actually quite warm.
And one of the first things we did was get a print from Paramount, took it to the Directors Guild, and screened it, and we were all shocked really about how great it looked and how we'd been looking cable TV and VHS versions for many, many years, and it just belied what the film truly looked like.
And unfortunately, even that print was missing the overture.
Yes.
That some projectionist, you know, had thought, what's all this extra leader at the beginning of the film?
And we had another wonderful guy, Richard Klein, the director of photography on this, who'd also worked with Bob on the Andromeda Strain, participating in this and working with us and making it look the way that it should. And just so many things come back as we watch this.
Yeah, I remember a considerable amount of, you know, there were some flaws in some of the shots, like the little, the
floating
guy in the
little
space
blue,
suit and
the little blue dot
that
yeah.
was in the Klingon shot that we had to paint out shot frame by frame.
We should maybe say as quickly as possible, but, you know, just to summarize for anybody who might not know, is that really what was released in 1979, as far as Bob Wise was concerned, was a first rough cut of the picture. They were locked into a release date. It was an extraordinary number of challenges meeting that date. And somebody said that even if it had to have black leader in it, it had to go out on that date.
That was Michael Eisner, and it was even in his book.
He was head of Paramount at the time.
That if the film was had black leader, it was going to go out as it was. It was also funny that Richard Klein had mentioned to us that everyone seemed really uncomfortable about the original release of the film because how rushed it was, that there was a funny story they once told us that they took out the largest stage at MGM when they were printing the film, and they had the film cans lined up in a row, and he remembered walking in there, and he got this sinking feeling like it was like little tombstones.
Right. Well, reel one would come in, they'd drop it in the cans. Right. Reel two would come in. When they had a full set of cans, it went on to a plane and off to the theater.
So here comes the real star of this director's edition, the planet Vulcan.
One of the major stars.
There is so much to talk about, because what Dave was mentioning about the coldness of the film and trying to warm it up, part of the rush of this production was that what really could have been a fantastic sci-fi classic is actually in this film. You just have to look a little bit harder to find it. And
gorgeous work by Foundation.
I just want to say that the Dave Morton, who did the matte paintings for these, did an absolutely spectacular job, and I think it really gives us the feeling of Vulcan, and it relates to every other Vulcan that we've seen.
Did the did anybody ever mention about the digital Spock there?
Sure.
I think that was covered.
That was in the docs.
It was covered. I think that was in the documentary. Yeah,
it was a documentary on the special effects for the director's edition.
But what other people don't know is that these shots as well have a little changes to them.
On the left side of the boot.
On the left side of the boot, there was some kind of underground, it looked like a refinery or something.
Actually, think of what it was the docking port for the Vulcan shuttle we see later.
Ah,
really, and small,
you know,
planet.
It was, which Yurisich did the matte paintings for this?
It was Matt.
Matthew,
yeah.
And he actually started working on one that looked like what we all ended up with on that establishing shot, which combined painting with a forced perspective plate done at Yellowstone.
Right.
And they ended up scrapping that and going for this crazy thing with moons in the sky and this shuttle port there. And, you know, it somehow didn't feel that it would work to know that if you went for this monastic purging that Spock is going through, that you could just say, well, this isn't working out for me.
There.
You know, you wanted to imagine that he had to walk across the desert for days and go without food, and it really needed to be desolate.
And let me just mention something quickly here about this, the layout of this Vulcan temple. As you notice on the floor, the tiles are basically set in a six-sided pattern. And on the necklace that she gives Spock, there's also a six-sided figure on there. And V'ger itself is a six-sided object. So we began to realize that this six-sided object could theoretically represent total logic itself. And so we set out the backstory and figuring out what this Vulcan temple would look like. We made a giant six-sided plateau with one of these statues at each of the pinnacles of it. And so it actually does make sense in the overall scope of the design of the movie.
Yet all based on the storyboards that they actually had originally done. That they really didn't get to accomplish the way they had been initially designed.
And I was really happy that we saw later on Enterprise they used the same temple design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely kept consistent with everything else.
San Francisco.
Now, who shot the plate for this, Darren?
This was one of our friends who actually was a co-creator of Lightwave. And his name is Alan Hastings, and he shot the plates for these up in San Francisco.
One of the things that was great about the Spock in his outfit, we actually found early proof photos of caveman Spock in a loincloth and a big skin over him on the bridge of the Enterprise. That these were test photos that we found. That was just amazing. But they've never been seen. But it was just, we were looking at this, thinking about what the possibilities were to have this caveman come out.
There was no doubt about it that the effects work on the film originally was truly spectacular. But if you analyzed it very closely, you saw how in a lot of instances they just got by. And I think when we saw the original effects storyboard book, we just were all astounded at really what was designed, what was planned, and what they weren't able to do.
It showed a much more completed vision than we got.
I always thought it was just funny that they built this escalator there. That's not an escalator, but if you look at it, it was just a moving staircase. Darren, you want to say something about how much work was put into that one, the shot of the station, the headquarters?
There was a lot of work, just basically extending it out to, you know, give Mr. Wise more of the vast expanses that he wanted and that was impossible from the plates that they had shot with the tram being in front of this basically big brown wall. And so we figured out a way to extend it out without having to affect the live-action plates.
We should say that the principal effects artists on the film were the great Doug Trumbull, who had just come off of Close Encounters of the Third Kind when he did this, and was very famous for 2001.
Right.
John Dykstra, who had originally been his assistant when they worked on the graphics for Bob's Andromeda Strain. And then John went off and became the visual effects supervisor, won an Oscar for the original Star Wars. And then when they got into a bind with finishing the effects for this, they worked together and basically split them. So this orbital office for the San Francisco Yard was really the introduction of the Doug's entertainment effects group work on the film. Prior to this, we've seen Dykstra's work primarily on the Klingon battle that opened the film, and the paintings, as earlier mentioned by Matt Yurasich.
It was at this time that we were beginning to do the project that we realized we were going to go back and speak to Doug and John, that at the same time we realized if we can get them together and do, not to get them together, but all the people we knew we were going to be speaking to about the history, that we should also record the interviews for them. So we ended up doing all of the interviews for the special features and such, because we were already hunting down the people, and we felt that it was a good way to get our answers, but also have that, those interviews shared.
They all did look at our work and everything, and they really saw that we were making it all look as if it had been done at the time or could have been done at the time, and that it would blend seamlessly and actually make their work look better. And just to give it that extra notch that we all imagined in our love of Star Trek at the time that was really there. But when we looked at it closely, we saw that there's just small improvements that could be made, small enhancements, without really changing the overall film as an experience. We wanted it to be the film that you really thought you saw when you first went to see it. And the other thing is, I think that we hoped that if somebody had never seen it or never seen any Star Trek, that if they watched this movie, we would pull them in. And Bob always wanted to, you know, attract just the average moviegoer to an entertaining experience. And maybe then you'd go check out other Star Trek and watch the many other films and the shows that exist. This scene, I think when we first started talking about this project and a few trusted friends that we mentioned, this always came up, this scene, because this became kind of infamous.
Well, if you're a Star Trek fan, you love the view of the Enterprise. If you're, it seems to have been, if you're a member of the public who wasn't a huge Star Trek fan, you'd wonder why we're spending all this time going around the ship.
And they expected that this would be the first thing that we cut out. Or
cut down considerably.
I don't think we ever for a moment considered cutting it down. There are several forces at work in this amazing scene. One of them is Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, because here in this 5 or 6 minute sequence, it's everything that he believed in. This possibility that if we just sort of get over ourselves, we could actually have this. We could actually be going up and there is a spaceship ready to go to other star systems, travel, meet other life forms, you know, and that we could actually get to that point with just a little bit of work. And then the other force you have is Doug Trumbull with his concept of first-person cinema, where you set up the narrative and then you back the characters out of it so that you, as an audience member, are the character in the movie. You are in this travel pod experiencing this, looking at this incredible vessel ready for launch. And the other thing is that Trumbull pulls it off in a very realistic way. You notice you could linger on these shots much, much longer than almost any shot is held in a film made nowadays, effects or otherwise. You know, you really buy the image. And of course, then the other, in my opinion, the other force at work here is Jerry Goldsmith, who wrote this 5-minute, 58-second cue called The Enterprise that you just cannot take one note out of. It's absolutely perfect. The dialogue goes away, and it becomes what movie making is all about. That combination of image, sound that creates emotion, and you don't need anything else in the way. You can't touch it.
One change we did make in this sequence is coming up, and it's a subtle thing, but it really connects to the humanity of the story by, funny enough, showing the Enterprise in a shot that we hadn't seen it before. And that is the shot of Captain Kirk looking out the front view screen, and we see the reflection of his love on the outside of the pod. There it is.
Mm-hmm. It really went from a simple close-up to an image that, to me, encapsulates all of Star Trek in that one image. And that was directly inspired by Doug Trumbull, who wanted to really do that throughout the sequence. But again, they had a phrase that was going around their effects facility at the time they were making this, which was crop it, flop it, or drop it. They had to take the path of least resistance in a lot of this work to just get a sequence together that made sense. And I think Jerry really saved a lot of that with this, what to me is the greatest score that he's ever made, that he's ever composed, and one of the greatest scores in the history of film music.
I always felt that this sequence was also a gift to all of the people who dreamt of going off into space and had their Enterprise models, and you'd hold up your model and you'd look at it, and it's like giving you a great representation of being able to go around and look at the new model as this beautiful introduction of the ship where it is today.
And the Enterprise herself has never looked better than mm-hmm. in this sequence.
Well, certainly for Star Trek fans, it just was an amazing thing to go from that, the outdated effects from the late 60s, which you still loved anyway, but to be able to go and see it and hold on it for this length of time and have it really be believable, it just was astounding. And I think that anybody who suggested that this be cut had never seen this on a big screen where it was meant and where it was designed to be shown. Because when you did look at it in the theater, it was blown away. You never were bored. You never thought of losing a second. You wanted to study every corner of the frame.
Rick Sternbeck, who I got to work with on the pilot of Voyager, tells this story of being called. He worked on Star Trek: The Motion Picture as one of the illustrators, and he was called in one day to teach Scotty how to fly the space pod because they hadn't really given the actors any instruction of what to do or how to look like they're flying this thing. And so Rick went into the stage one morning and sat there and told Scotty how to fly.
Yet we don't see the controls a single time.
Well, nowadays in the future, it's hit a button and it does it. So there's something really to be said about the design of this whole film, that it set a much higher standard than the original show had, that I think really carried on to the subsequent movies and the subsequent shows, that the beautiful aspects of this film, the beautiful designs, even the ship with the glowing engines, etc., helped raise the bar for the show and everything else that was going on subsequently, all the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. And
it did raise the bar, I think, just in general for science fiction filmmaking, and that was going on in other films at the time. This was the year of Alien, the year after Superman, as I mentioned before, and of course Star Wars, Close Encounters, fantastic visionary, timeless classics now.
We were talking about the audio work here. I remember that we were bringing up the elevator sound effect, almost as if the elevator was beckoning him, don't step out into the bridge, was something I remembered having a conversation with Chuck Michael, our sound supervisor for the film. And there was so much work that we were really serious about making sure the sound played a tremendous role in this picture. And I told Chuck at the beginning of the project, you're going to get us the PG rating, which we actually were able to get for the film. And you watch this film, there's nothing that really would say this is going to be a PG rated picture, especially when it was rated before. So the work that Chuck and his group did was just phenomenal in helping that happen. And we'll talk about more of the specifics when those scenes come up.
What you just saw was the first dialogue scene. That little exchange after Kirk left the bridge, little moment that was not in the film when it was originally released in 1979. It was shown on the television versions, but that illustrates this whole idea of focusing on the humanity of the picture. And I mentioned earlier about how this really is a flawed science fiction classic. I think that there was this idea that you were going to redesign the Enterprise. It was going to be state of the art. And so consequently, there would just be this technology overload. The computers spoke and the machines seemed to run everything. The problem was we ultimately get to what they're going after and they find that V'ger is a machine. So the machines became everything about the story. But instead, I think what needed to happen and what we attempted to do, since we couldn't really change the movie, was to show that on the Enterprise, it was nothing without the people. It had to be what the tagline on the poster said. It had to be a human adventure. And the problem, the essential problem in this movie that maybe if they'd had more time to work on the script, they could have gotten that far, is that this inability of people to work together and to connect to each other is the essential problem. And it mirrors V'ger's problem, his or its feeling of incompleteness and needing to connect with something, which it does physically. And I noticed, and God, Bob hated when I pointed out this kind of symbolism and stuff in his films. He always said he never intended. You're talking about a guy who didn't see the Christ metaphors in the Day of the Ursa still, okay? Mm-hmm. But the shot where the travel pod docks with the Enterprise, that image of things connecting to each other is a motif that goes throughout the film. In the Vulcan scene, you saw Spock refuse the connection. He pushes that necklace away. He doesn't want that connection because he's sensing the calling of something else. And later on, when Spock's shuttle docks, and then it ultimately leads to the trip into V'ger, which, if you think about it also, this movie is about going out into space and exploring. That's what Star Trek is about. But what do we end up with? We end up with a plot that goes inside. We're constantly moving into things. We go into a cloud, we go into a vessel, we go into a chamber in that vessel, and we end up with a little island and a little wire that's not connected. And you know, the story that's really going on here is about the need for people to connect to each other. And we try to just go further with that. And the way to do that was to focus on the people, get rid of the machines on the Enterprise as much as possible, make it about people.
What I need to comment about here for the scene was that this was one of the pivotal moments that I said to Chuck, this is going to, you know, this is part of our PG rating here. We need nails on the chalkboard, you know, chills down your spine. Imagine, and I remember saying to him, imagine, you know, you're this horrible ball of flesh looking for some form of yourself to scream out of. Just try to think of the most nightmarish thing you could think of to, you know, evoke and get that horrible sound. And I believe we really succeeded in accomplishing that frightening moment to make it even more frightening, because as a kid, it terrified me, the scene.
Do you think that moment gave us the PG?
I think that's one of the key moments that gave the PG, the power of the sound throughout the film did it, but that was one of the pivotal moments that did earn us the PG. There was another thing that Bob had mentioned here, and we had the benefit of a 20 years of preview screenings of the film being released. And
which was like the preview, because he didn't actually have one.
Right.
The preview was
Bob would have previewed the film. And there's been one of the questions here was Kirk had a line where he would go, "Oh my God." And that line almost always would gather a laugh from anybody who's watching. And here's this very serious sequence that, you know, these characters and these people have just died. And it was a bad laugh, as Bob, you know, as you'd call it. And that's one of the reasons that the line had to be pulled. But it's funny because with so many people being familiar with the film, there's people who have actually come up to us and said, "How could you pull the line? Oh my God, I loved it." And it's just not right for that moment. It's changing the tone away from the film. And that's why we needed to cut that line.
The other thing is that we found out that they shot a lot of incidental dialogue almost as protection, because they knew about the bind of this visual effects and worried that they might not have a coherent story. So if somebody actually came and said what was happening, it might fill in for an effect that didn't get made. So since the transporter effects were there and worked, it was very obvious that you needed that exchange between Shatner and Jimmy Doohan worked fine. And again, now it suddenly wasn't about a transporter malfunction. It was about two people just died.
If you look here at the people that are just standing here watching the view screen, the shortest woman in the front in a tan jumpsuit is actually Millicent Wise, Bob's wife.
Well, we could roll this scene back 40 times and constantly talk about all the people that they put in here. It was like this huge casting call of extras, plus anybody who was anybody in Star Trek at the time. There's another cut that was made in this scene that I've gotten complaints about since we finished this.
Me too.
But I absolutely stand by, and that's after this image that they're going to look of Epsilon 9 being destroyed or absorbed by V'ger. Admiral Kirk asks his chief communications officer to turn the viewer off. And in the original cut of the film, she freezes, staring either at her commanding officer or at a Federation emblem on the screen. I'm not sure which. But she freezes and has to be told twice to turn the viewer off while 430 crew members are standing there about to go after this thing to find out what it is, where they've just seen other Starfleet officers killed by it. And it just was very clear that, you know, you didn't want to have a command officer. You know, this crew would think, well, if we're in a crisis, is our communications officer going to just freeze and do nothing?
Right. I mean, these people have supposedly been out seeing wonders and strange things for at least 5 years.
Yeah.
And they probably have seen things maybe even worse than this. And, you know, they are a good group of people that know what to do, even under pressure.
And if you're working on that bridge, you're not going to freeze.
Look, a space station was destroyed by a cloud. You know, it's you know.
Which she's probably
I love this scene with this poor guy trying to outrun the
yeah.
the zapper laser rays.
It's a great image.
I can make it. I think I can make it. I'm pretty sure
again, the human element, it becomes not about the effects. Oof. It becomes about somebody dying.
And then he trips and dies.
Boom. Love the jury score.
See, now there's Admiral Kirk standing. We're really with the point of this doing this scene was that you heard on the old TV show about 430 crew people, but you never saw more than maybe 20.
What I love is
here they are. But now here he is, poor Kirk, standing there, have to stare his entire crew in the face. And what do I tell them? And he has to say, well, we're just going to get on with it, people.
There's some guy standing in the front row, Rob Klein, who is a prop expert and one of the people that worked with us on the project. There's a guy in the foreground, you may have to ring this back, that's wearing a white a piece of plastic on his, or a white console on his chest. And I believe it was Rob, who did some great work with us on the collecting materials for this project, who pointed out that that's actually the bottom section of a Cylon Raider model. From
well, I think
Battlestar
that,
Galactica.
I don't know if the Galactica, Dykstra's Galactica shop had really wrapped up it yet at this point, so they grabbed anything they could. There might have even been some Logan's Run costumes at Starfleet.
Oh, the lovely Persis Kambata.
Straight from George Lucas's THX 1138, including the Oath of Celibacy.
She obviously didn't take her oath very Persis. Seriously.
Miss a former Miss India who then died tragically at the age of 50 from a heart attack. So, but from all accounts, she was a lovely person. She was a carryover actually from the Star Trek Phase 2, which is how this movie originally began its life as Paramount's attempt to relaunch Star Trek as a television series with the entire original cast and
on their own network.
On their own network, which then didn't happen for another 20 years. But when that was aborted and they went for making a feature film, fortuitously in the wake of Star Wars, her character and that actress, as the bald Delton Ilea, was carried over.
And all the costs of developing that series were actually transferred to the budget of this film. And that's one of the reasons why it was very expensive.
What was great was that we did come across footage and lots of test footage and lots of photos from the filming. And there were two interesting things that we discovered from that footage. Number one, Well, two interesting... One thing that was great to observe was the...
Before you say that, I just want to say that McCoy is, in fact, not wearing the headpiece to the staff of Ra around his neck.
Uh-huh. That's like saying Uhura does not take fast food orders for Burger King.
That's right.
Because that's not a Burger King logo behind her. But
I do think he was beamed up directly from the Playboy Mansion.
He might have been, but if you remember, the one of the things we didn't change was that we didn't add his beard being beamed up. Because the outline of him doesn't have his beard, you know, a little thing that if somebody was nitpicking, they'd make a comment about.
The little moment that was added in, again, it was also in the TV extended version, that of the yeoman that comes up and gives that little, you know, introductory thing that you know McCoy is coming. Each of the three main characters have a very theatrical entrance in this film, which is a nice touch.
I need you badly.
I can't see you joke about that line, Darren, but it's like, you know, that's the whole theme.
I joke because I love.
Yeah, there's people who need each other. If they're going to go out and do this, if they're going to try to manage this technological, you know, marvel and go out to other planets, other civilizations, you know, they have to connect with each other. And everybody's very disconnected in this film. And I'm realizing that was a theme sort of in some of those movies that I mentioned at the time. Star Wars, you have what Darth Vader calls a technological terror, you know, and he himself is a technological terror. And what defeats it, you know, human beings coming together, people who say, may the force be with you, and have metal ceremonies. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which ended up not being about UFOs, but it was about being chosen, you know, and connecting with another life form. E.T., of course, was the pinnacle of that. That was sort of a theme throughout the science fiction films of this era, and Star Trek is about that just as much as those others.
Mike, do you remember the first time we went to Paramount? It was many, many years ago, and I remember walking past a dumpster, and we saw one of the Enterprise bridge panels,
mm-hmm.
and we just realized by that point that that bridge was never going to be seen again. Mm-hmm. They said that they had scrapped.
That was right after The Undiscovered Country, I believe.
Well, no, it was after Trek 4, because the bridge was still set up for that, and I think what was left over of the bridge might have ended up at Universal for the Maybe. Star Trek adventure at the time.
Notice the great subtle acting, and I'm being totally serious, the subtle acting by Shatner in this scene, how he's acting really nervous about taking the old girl out again.
Well,
and you can see his little
fingers
are, you know, just nervously tapping his chair.
Isn't this an element of the 48-year-old guy? Of course, we're all far from being 48. The 48-year-old guy who gets a Porsche. Isn't there an element of that in this?
This is Kirk's midlife crisis that he finally reconciles in Star Trek II.
It's funny that I remember Trumbull, this model, this gorgeous, amazing model that we were able to use, bring back for the project to create the CG model for the Enterprise, is about 8 feet tall, 8 feet long. But I remember Trumbull saying that it was just absolutely a brilliant size, but he would have gone even bigger.
Even bigger. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine?
That past shot of the Enterprise coming toward us and coming out of the dry dock was actually a shot that we changed for this project. Because if you'll notice in the original version,
or in Trek Two,
where it's still, you'll notice that the outline of a support rod coming out of the side of the Enterprise is blocking out the dry dock behind it.
I didn't notice it. You have to roll back.
I didn't notice it. Oh, you got
no,
rid of it.
That's we got right. rid of it. That's yeah. right.
Now, actually,
but for the next film, it was a different time that the Enterprise was launching. That time they needed a support arm. Right.
Coming up here is one of my absolute favorite changes.
Yes,
and I think it illustrates everything that I said before about focusing on the humanity. You're coming to the Enterprise about to fly into the outer reaches of the solar system, and there's an exchanged glance between Ilea and Decker, played by the great Stephen Collins. We also got to go over to Seventh Heaven set, where he just finished 11 seasons on that show. Unbelievable. And we took that from later on, and right here, and replaced What was there, like an Astro Gator?
It was the Astro Gator with lights blinking on and off.
Again, that was a shot of technology. What are we looking at? Why is it important? You know, this is about people going out into space who have relationships with each other, who long for connection with each other. And
now we're
it's
starting
those little
episode.
Changes without really affecting the overall film. It's just little things that they would have done had they previewed this film and saw there's too much of an emphasis on effects and technology. You know, and we need to make some of small changes to kind of even that balance out.
Well,
and it's a change like that that just helps it, in my estimation, just infinitesimally.
But wasn't the shot of the Astrogator also, they did lots of shots of technology and lights going off and things happening just to cover up the possible lack of visual effect.
The possible lack of something on the view screen.
Right.
So they had a panel to cut
so
to.
So many different things to cover. I want to go back before I lose track of this to phase two. The thing that we found that was unusual about the phase two footage was this was for a television show, yet they shot it widescreen. And we were wondering where that decision to
that was very interesting.
Look at this as a movie when everyone was still wearing the old uniforms and they were suddenly doing these widescreen shots that wouldn't be for television. So
well, also before the television show, it was going to be a movie. Mm-hmm. There was development for a film as early as
75,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the prospect of new Star Trek had existed for several years, and they just didn't exactly know what to do with it.
Well, I think they made the right choice.
See, Kirk is here, you know, if I can just get to warp speed, if I could just get this ship under my control, everything will be the way that it should be.
Right.
But he has this journey in this film of coming to the conclusion that it's not about that at all. It's about connecting with people, and he's really not completed till Spock comes back. And he changes after that.
It's almost like it's a bit of an insecurity that he doesn't have until his team is complete.
Mm-hmm. And again, this wormhole sequence that's now starting with incredible effects that supervised by Doug Trumbull. Again, it's like it was probably there because somebody wanted to show what some of the mishaps of warp travel could be, but it plays into this whole theme because you see illustrated here the essential problem is these people are literally out of sync with each other.
And this wormhole actually was done by Dykstra's people.
Oh,
because it was a scanning laser that they put on the motion control rig and stretched it out through time exposure. But it's still amazing.
But these effects
amazing.
On the bridge, too?
No, these effects on the bridge were done by the effects animation crew. And
the Robert Swarth?
Yes.
Okay. And if I remember correctly, they also had to shoot 35 millimeter and 65 millimeter
right.
on a lot of these angles. It was weeks and weeks and weeks that in the 60s, they probably would have made 10 episodes of Star Trek.
Sure.
If I'm correct, this was the first sequence that was really completed, too.
That's correct.
For the effects.
It was in a very early promo reel.
Yeah, short of some minor editing during the sequence, this is just really was brilliant.
Another,
there was no changes that we needed.
Another area there where the sound work was fantastic.
Right.
People may not know that when you make a film, you cannot do your sound edit until the picture is locked. Well, when your picture is not locked until 2 weeks before you have to be in theaters, you have no time to do any sound work. So Jerry's score covered a lot of that shortfall originally. And in fact, his last recording session was on December the 2nd of 79, 5 days before this thing was in theaters.
Yeah.
And if you go back and listen to or watch and listen to the original version of the film, you will hear that the bridge of the Enterprise is pretty much dead. They may be stuck in some room tone to cover
and made of wood.
Edits. Yes. And everything was designed, but there was no, the sound editors would wait until the picture's locked and say, okay, go ahead and now do your sound. No
Chuck,
time.
Chuck had played for us over and over again these audio beds that they had created for the film for all different scenes, this whole, you know, effects, sound effects sequences that just never made it into the dub for time.
We replaced the explosion of the asteroid in the end of this sequence. And
it was such an anticlimax.
Well, it never made sense to
because they basically
people.
Cut to a stock shot of right. an explosion. And no one realized what was going on, and it was a last-minute fix that they did.
Now, there was one elimination that we did made. Very funny story. The original version following the explosion was a shot of Persis Kambata as Ilia in her navigator's station. bouncing as the Enterprise is bounced.
Kind of.
And let's say certain parts of her anatomy
were bouncing more than others.
Were more distracting.
Right. So when we show this scene to Doug Trumbull, he says, ah, she's bouncing too much. And I said, well, we're taking that out. And he says, oh, you're taking out the bounce? I said, no, we're taking out the shot. He says, okay, good. But that
it
was
didn't
that
match
was
with
that
the rest was, of the rest of the shot. You know, she was bouncing, but the shot was
cut again because they had no effect. So how are you going to show? You know, but now the scene as it was finished. I mean, to me, it's harrowing. It's just harrowing to find to watch.
A good point to make is the removal of the obvious statements at this point.
Right.
Where
again, you know, people would say we're out of it, or the shields
held.
The
new screens held.
Right, but because they filmed those lines because. If they didn't come up with an effect that would show us that, somebody had to make it clear to the audience.
It became really interesting to have 20 years of knowledge and memory of the film, yet having to go back and still look at it from the perspective of we're telling the story and not get caught in the familiarity of what we've seen.
Dozens of HBO viewings went out the window the day that we brought a print to the Directors Guild, the big theater at the Directors Guild, and watched it and was like, wow.
And they were really kind to screen it two times for us with Bob.
That's right. The second time we brought the entire crew from Foundation Imaging down and
on
said...
On the 20th anniversary.
It was actually on December 7th, 1999.
And we celebrated with making an event for Bob. He didn't know about it.
We had actually hoped to originally have this done for that date. Do you remember that?
I do.
But, you know, Paramount, I mean, at least they eventually said okay and gave us the green light. It took a while to get to that point because my initial conversations with Bob Wise about this was right after George Lucas did his famous changes to the Star Wars trilogy in early 97. And then... there was a lot of talk at that time about other films that were supposedly unfinished. There was never a better argument for that than this picture.
Speaking of the of how our goal was for having this completed for the 10th anniversary.
20th
anniversary, of course. The goal was for a theatrical re-release of the film. And when we went to the studio... there was a question of what we could do with this. And in the end, our goal was always for theatrical presentation, but we were given an opportunity to do it for DVD. The entire project was designed, planned, still is ready for being completed in the high-def and theatrical format, so that this version, which Bob has now proclaimed is... his final version of the film is to stand the test of time. Should be in its highest resolution for high def or otherwise. The point is that with the 30th anniversary coming out, it's a new goal of mine to see if we can.
Well, we definitely need to get back and do it. Should be done. I think Paramount has to realize that it needs to be done. We're just waiting to see when that opportunity will present itself.
Yeah, we've had on and off, you know, communications with them about it, but with the 30th anniversary coming out, that's when I'd like to see it ready in time for.
Here, McCoy lays it on the line for Kirk and tells him what his problem is. Mm-hmm. Nobody has actually stood up to Kirk. We heard that Kirk stood up to an admiral to get the command of the Enterprise back, and now the only person who's on this ship who would dare say this to him. Finally lays on the line what the essential problem of this movie is. The essential problem of the movie is not that this giant cloud is moving towards Earth. It's that Kirk is disconnected.
View screens are really big in this.
Could this be Spock?
I'd like to know why, when that view screen goes off, is an image of the Partridge Family bus there.
Well, obviously, in the 23rd century...
your art turns
it's
into...
It's retro.
Yeah.
Turns into your view screen.
Yeah, it's a retro 20th century.
Or it's one hell of a big
again,
game
again,
of
I
Simon.
Mentioned about the things that Bob used to always hate that I would point out. This shot of the door closing,
right.
I mean, to me, it's so symbolic. Kirk is unenlightened. He's like, that's not why I shot that. I'm like, well, maybe it was. You just didn't know it. And then we go to an even darker shot. Do you remember how dark this movie looked in theaters?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the space was really black in this film. When you were not orbiting a planet, which you aren't at all in this film other than Earth, there should theoretically not be any light from any stars, which is why Trumbull came up with the concept of the Enterprise illuminating itself. So you go from this Kirk being darkened to the blackness of a space, and then into that comes this Vulcan shuttle. Here's another great bit of Jerry Goldsmith music. Not sure if you can actually see this in the picture, maybe in 70 millimeter, but they never did one. That's the name of that shuttle is actually the Surak.
Yes.
It's announced that it's a Federation registered shuttle. You don't know what it is. It's the music that tells you that it's Spock and that it's Vulcan.
Now, isn't that the only shot, Darren, inside the
inside
deck?
Right.
And here, again, is this connection. You physically see the models connecting. You'd think it would be just as easy to beam him on, and it would be. But A, we get this theatrical entrance, as I mentioned before, and B, it has that theme of connection. We see the technology connecting to each other. Now the people have to do that, too.
There's also a point of this here that the mechanical voices were taken away to, you know, have a human being acknowledge that, you know, there's a border, well, that it's not as cold.
We even saw that in the 24th century, they didn't have talking computers. There was a lot of talk about talking computers in the early days of computers in the 20th century. And at the time that the original Star Trek was on the air, well, guess what? We're now in the 21st century. Do we like talking computers? We have them. They don't sound very good.
No.
They talked about getting to HAL, but we didn't get to HAL.
I like 2001.
We don't like them.
I would like a 2001 HAL. And the movie's great.
I'd like a 2001 HAL, too. I just don't want him to kill me.
Especially since the computers, as some of the characters do, state the obvious in a lot of, you know,
right.
We don't need to be told that the negative helm control, you know, 14 mm-hmm. times. It was a great idea at the time, and there were science advisors, and we all respected that and respected what Roddenberry was trying to do, which was to update Star Trek and really make us feel that it was a technological wonder, but the technology is useless without the people connecting with each other, working together. Nowadays, we all feel plugged into technology. We all feel like we're part of the matrix, right? But if we were to really get out there and be so far away from Earth and the place that has grass and trees, you know, the only thing we'd have is each other, just a bunch of machines.
So Spock comes back, and he turns out to be a real jerk. And because he's disconnected from himself, he doesn't know who he is. He's trying to be Vulcan. He's trying to be less human.
He thinks he's looking for V'ger, yeah. But he's not. He's looking for Kirk.
When we were laying out the project, we were talking about what might have been missing, and that we always felt that Kirk's performance, that he was missing to a certain degree. And I can't, you know, I'm so amazed by the edit here that I really think we found Kirk.
We had to pull out was all these, hope this isn't a G-rated commentary on a PG movie, but we have to take out every instance of Kirk bitching at somebody, which he did several times. Those all came out. His disconnectedness, I think, plays fine and fully there. That cut of Spock walking out, cut to Kirk and McCoy, and then boom, you get Sandy Courage's original series theme. It shows you where we need to get to.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get to Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and that music all being back together.
What we actually found in the script, earlier drafts of the script at least, was that there was a moment where Spock is walking down the hall, and we felt that there was a point where he needed to lose it a little. And there was a point where he walks into a
Bulkhead.
It was like a separate room. I think he just separates himself from everybody.
That's right.
And he loses his composure for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that really showed the pain that
he was under. Yeah, because he, as we know, Vulcans have emotions. They just suppress them. And maybe Spock had this unexpected reaction of seeing Kirk and McCoy again.
And Bob's wink just now.
Mm-hmm.
Bob has this amazingly charming wink.
That Shatner was channeling Bob there.
That's clear.
last time I remember him doing it was when we did the sing-along Sound of Music at the Hollywood Bowl with 18,000 people, and that famous iconic shot of helicopter coming into Julie Andrews. And I looked at him, and he gave me that wink. He knew, you know, power.
I've gotten so much feedback about this officer's lounge shot and the nacelles showing out the window.
Well, we actually talked about going far more elaborate with this set itself, right?
Yeah.
We probably could now. But again, I think it was good that we were restricted. We kept it feeling like the same movie. But that was one that we debated, and ultimately we went for it.
You were saying, Darren?
Well, it's just that, where is this lounge? And what are we seeing behind there? And why are the stars seeming to go sideways and things like that? And this is the view that you would get. I put a camera in our model and put it at this location. We're figuring that this is pretty near the large rec deck that we saw
earlier. The
level
above it.
Right. And that this is the upper level of the rec deck behind the big atrium. And this is the view of the engines that you get with that lens.
So if you physically were on the ship looking out that window, that's what you would see.
Well, we had never seen part of the Enterprise from inside the Enterprise.
You'd never seen the connection of the inside and the outside. And we thought that
Spock's...
And how they don't give it a second thought. Right. Nobody's standing looking out the window right. Marveling about it because they look at it every day. I'm reminded here also of the production designer, Hal Michelson, who we lost very recently.
Yeah, just a few
wonderful,
months ago.
Wonderful man. And I remember him talking about this set, how it was basically thrown together. It wasn't anything like the large expanse that it was mm-hmm. originally storyboarded as. And he got cardboard boxes from the back lot and upholstered them. And that's what's in the background for a lot of this.
I don't know what to say.
Darren, I must say also the way that the composition ended up here was perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it looked like that was there first, and then then you stayed to the actors around it. But it was actually done 20 years later. That must be the bar back there. Either that or the perfume counter.
Right.
Samples testing.
You see how they have behind McCoy is a little tubular thing with what looked like greenery in it.
Looks
right?
like a hydroponic garden or something.
I'm not going to talk about what Scotty's saying or where it came from, but I did see the subtitles that they put in on the closed caption, the text track.
Yes.
They had no clue what he was saying.
That's good. But you see, originally, I mean, I think that the computer was going red alert over and
right.
over and over. It was the red alert for the visually impaired.
Right.
In case you missed the red lights and the people running around.
And the big sign that says red alert.
Right, that there was a voice telling you that the ship was now on red alert.
Right.
Now we start, I love that.
There's the Burger King logo right. behind it.
Yes, Captain, I lost Starfleet, but in case you want any French fries, I can get some. You know,
yeah, that's not a Burger King logo, that music, but it always looked that way.
All right, that music that came in on the shot of the cloud on the view screen when they first see it, that incredible pipe organ that was at the Fox scoring stage, which was taken out about 10 years ago. It's the same organ used on The Sound of Music and anything else that was recorded at Fox over the years, going all the way back to the 30s. And it's the haunted house. That's what Jerry's telling you there. This may be a cloud. God knows how big it is. Actually, we know how big it is.
Right.
But
now it's over, two AUs in diameter.
Okay, which is twice the distance from Earth.
From the Earth to the sun.
Okay.
So instead of 82 AUs, I think Chuck did a great job getting it down to two.
That's
sounds like
right.
a pregnant pause.
But anyway, despite the vastness of that idea, this is really a bunch of kids facing the neighborhood haunted house.
Right.
And what's going to come on if you had a scene like that is this scary organ. You know, Jerry was had this incredible instinct for capturing exactly what you need to be feeling. And in a movie like this, which had so many delays with the effects, and the script was not quite as honed as it could have really been had they taken a little more time with it, but he manages to fill in that those missing links incredibly. There are people, probably from older than we are, who will mention some of Jerry's scores from the 60s as the greatest thing he ever wrote. To me, there's just no competition. This is just...
There is no comparison.
No comparison, that's right.
Which is... I always found that amazing considering he didn't have anything to write to. Mm-hmm.
And he did... again, it was very rushed. There was a lot of times where they had no footage. So they would record seven versions of Ilya's theme.
And
Lionel Newman would come in and record versions of the Star Trek theme.
But they also had the advantage of that they listened to the music and they sent Jerry back a few times to come up with.
Yeah, he did six or seven cues that didn't work out, and before he came up with the main Star Trek theme, which is now the most famous thing he's ever written.
It became the opening of Next Generation, of course.
He got Sandy Courage himself in to do the quotes of the original Star Trek television show theme, and then later on, Sandy became his main orchestrator throughout the 90s. And then I think Fred Steiner, who had written some original series scores, came in to put some of the cues together, like the one that just ended, I believe. Now, this scene went through a lot of changes. There were basically two different versions of it. There were some mislabeled numbers in the script, so things got edited incorrectly.
To those of you who caught it, this little in joke is the Spocks around the warp engine right there. What's funny is years later, I'm not even going to talk about what it is, but if anyone notices that years later, I went to Richard Anderson at who was one of the original sound designers on the film, and it was something that he always intended to put in, but never had time to put it in. And when he saw this version, he was so happy because it was exactly where he was planning to put it.
That's
a little
great
sound effect that was there. Because it's pretty much the only place you can have that effect, that sound effect.
Unless you put it over Chekhov.
That's right.
You're not
added that's footage right here of Majo Barrett, Mrs. Roddenberry, entering the bridge to tend to Chekhov's wound. And we find out that Ilya has healing ability again. This idea of the physical connection between people, that was missing in the 79 version entirely. We took advantage of one of the unused Jerry Goldsmith cues to put a little score in that sequence. Bob kept saying, I need to see Decker. We need a shot of Decker, who you see him from the neck down there. And I went to the cutting script, the continuity script, which has all of the numbers of what where all the slates were. And I said, Bob, you did one take of that. And I've had them looking for that number in the cans that came in and that they were looking through. And I said, we can't find it. It just isn't there. I don't think we can get that cut. That's probably the one thing he specifically asked for that we couldn't do. Again, he wanted to foreshadow that... what ultimately happens to Decker and Ilya.
Meanwhile, in space.
Now we get back to, some slight recutting here to what it was originally, because, again, there was some interactive lighting that didn't match up because of mislabeled slates. And you had a shot of Decker that didn't match up with, he was leaning over the desk in one shot and standing there looking at the screen in another shot. And then it all climaxed with an effect that didn't come in.
An effect that looked like, well, in the final film, that was a jump cut.
Well, like a light bulb
going out. To nothing on the screen. And we finally have a sound effect for the transmission there.
And I would never, ever have any problem believing that that wasn't done in 1979.
Yeah.
That was one of the most prominent goals, was that we don't go over the top, you know, showing off what's possible now. It was to embrace everything that was possible at the time and match it to be that you can't tell what was new, what was old, what we pulled an effects element and reused, what was... computer generated or not, what, you know, the goal was that everything would be flawless and invisible to the viewer. It's the greatest compliment.
Or at least as flawed as the original footage.
Right. Or as dirty as the original footage for that matter.
That's why we did have to put like a grain pass onto things to match it, right?
Yeah, we've passed, the film was supposed to go through a much, much more serious, dirt and cleanup, but in the end, what was released, and We felt that everything needed to be consistent, also just to make it match. You couldn't have one suddenly pristine, clean shot where everything else is dirty.
Again, that last exchange that just took place there between Kirk and Spock and Decker, that was originally cut out of the film. The reason why things were cut out of the film is because part of the deal of meeting that date was also meeting a running time of precisely not to exceed 130 minutes maximum. And when the effects work was not in, they needed to cut back dialogue in order to accommodate it when it did come in. Of course, then, as said before, not having any opportunity to weigh one against the other and decide maybe we can cut some of these long effects and put back in some of this dialogue that we trimmed. There was never that opportunity. So that's the reason why a lot of those things were cut, put in on a network broadcast in the early 80s. The fans had a very positive reaction to it, so much so that Paramount released that version on videotape, and it was the official version. Bob was not informed about it, and so he was not happy about it, really, because of the state that it was in. It was sort of, it was almost like a work print cut into it, and then we found that they even did that to some prints.
It was a Sit Long and Prosper.
Remember the first, the show
year
off
was?
91, the,
it's 20, 91, the 20th. They actually went back in and took, with the exception of Kirk leaving the Enterprise, they printed those sequences and reincorporated them into the prints. And
so when we called,
even when we went
in,
to the studio and said, we want to make sure we get Bob's theatrical cut, they said, absolutely, we have that one. And they delivered it to us, and we actually found that it was the best prints that they had, which was the Sit Long and Prosper.
Right, which I wasn't opposed
marathon.
To seeing.
Well, Bob wanted to look at his film as this is
right.
The way I left it. That's where it became so difficult for Bob through this process, and even to up to his death.
To figure out what the movie was.
No, but I mean, he did. He finished the film in the form of the director's edition, and he's so happy with the film. And it's funny, he'd had a smile that I hadn't seen in him smile a certain way for anything but how proud he was of this project. And it touched my heart when the publicist from Paramount handed us a photo where it captured that,
mm-hmm.
that moment, and it was amazing. But the problem is that today the film is still being seen in the rough cut version from 79.
Right, it's shown on the high def and satellite channels, right?
And special longer version, of course, was out, but I haven't seen that being shown any other way. But the original version isn't Bob's finished picture, and you know, it does have a historical significance, but if you did work that couldn't be completed and then you completed the work, you'd want people to appreciate what your overall final goal was, which was Bob's goal to have this be and stand as the final and finished version of the movie. So when people think of Star Trek The Motion Picture by Robert Wise, this is what they get, and that's what he wanted. And, you know, it's still disappointing to see that other version is still being seen. Not that it doesn't have historical significance, but you know, you finish the film, you want people to see it the way that it was intended.
Well, I think eventually we'll get to a point where it is done. I'm optimistic about it getting done, and I think that the other film should be preserved as well, because I remember cutting school to go see it the day it opened, and I'll tell you, it's not in the way that I cut school. I was the kind of kid who handed in term papers way ahead of the due date, but I cut school the day this opened by telling the teacher that I had that I'm not coming to class tomorrow, I'm going to see Star Trek. And she said, okay. So I went to school actually till the first couple classes, till noon, then left. Went to go see it opening day.
I know that that you guys have mentioned this. I think I'm in agreement that, at least by now with some of the comments, that I'd like to see some type of high-definition box set that does have the original version. So that can be appreciated and then has...
Well, I mean, on the DVD of this that came out...
all has the director's edition.
The clips from the original version and the TV version, for that matter, were included there. But the focus, having multiple versions on that release, would have taken the emphasis away from this. And I think that was the whole point of this release, was to say, this is the director's edition. Now, I think it has sold itself. People really like it. There's no way that anybody can... look at it and not see it as a valuable commodity. To somebody, as I said before, who had never seen Star Trek, they would, for a million reasons, would be more attracted to this version, there's no reason to not release it. And I think, you know, we've gotten into the home video industry enough to get to the point where we can just put all the existing versions there in one set. Be nice.
Here we have the...
I'd buy it.
The introduction of the V'ger vessel itself, and that, of course, was done by Dykstra's team.
Right, we made a transition there through that cloud sequence, which was Trumbull's team, right, coming into Dykstra, who did the...
Who did the physical
model. The physical model of the V'ger craft. Now, these sequencers are very interesting because, again, they came under a lot of criticism by people over the years, even people who like the film, that you spend 3-4 minutes going through a cloud, you spend 3-4 minutes traveling across a vessel. And again, they were kept at that length because the footage was cut first, before effects work came in. Then when those effects shots came in, they were simply dropped into the holes waiting for them. Jerry scored it, and out it went. You know, I can't say enough about Jerry, who I'm... he had a reputation of being very, very gruff, but I gotta say, for the number of times that I got together with him over this project, he just was, I thought he was just the dearest man, very, very funny. We had a fantastic experience of debuting 20 minutes of this version of the film at the Hollywood Bowl with my good friend John Malcherry conducting the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra.
Featuring the live performance of the blaster beam instrument.
Right, which we found Craig Huxley came in and brought the beam. And
you should talk about the call you made to him about, do you have a blaster beam?
But yeah, getting that actually on the stage and doing several cues, 20 minutes worth of footage, and sitting there with Bob Wise.
That was amazing.
And Jerry. And we also did sections from Planet of the Apes that night and Alien.
Yes. There was nothing in my life like seeing the premiere of your work
in front
of 18,500 people,
and they
with your
it.
Director and your composer, and just showing these amazing things to everybody. And just
we were joined that night by a couple of other fantastic people. John Povel, who was the associate producer on the film, was actually on the project with as Roddenberry's assistant back when it was going to be a TV series, and his wife Michelle, who is the first person to speak English in the film, right?
Right.
I think she's the communications officer at
Epsilon 9,
who first reports on this Klingon listening, their spy satellite into the Klingon Empire.
Now, this sequence was trimmed down slightly.
Yeah, again, I started to talk about that, and of course went off on a tangent, but... it was very obvious candidates when you for cutting down, because you could still tell the story and significantly gain back some of your running time to put back some dialogue in. And we had an extraordinary benefit on this because I told Bob what I wanted to do. I said, here's the opportunity here is to not mess too much with the music. I could go in and not look at the picture and do a music edit on it, bring these two cues down, and then recut the picture to that, because the music is really what drives it sonically. It's the dominating element of these two sequences. So I spoke to Jerry about that, and he said, I always expected that some of those scenes would be cut down, so I deliberately wrote music that would lend itself to that, with a lot of these repeating patterns. And I should also point out that this V'ger motif that we hear, some of it is a dark version of Ilea's theme. And a lot of it is in the time signature of 6/8, which again helps us with that whole motif of the sixes. That everything has to do with V'ger seems to revolve around. But of course, Jerry says, no, I had no idea about that.
It's funny, the only piece of V'ger that I ever saw in this show was we just passed a circular dish that was being held by another little long extension coming from the right, but in the circle was there. And I was visiting Pat McClung once, and he pulled out of a closet, you know, this little thing about the size of the headpiece of the Staff of Ra, and piece. Just surprising that it was just a small...
By the way, this shot, I need to interrupt you, Dave, because this is, you know, in every project, there are things that get away that you can't do. This was one.
It's one of the ones that Bob
that was on our list. We had to give a few things back. And the Enterprise actually needs to do a 180-degree turn there so that it's then facing the end of V'ger, which was the order that Kirk gave. We simply weren't able to make that change there.
This is one of our shots.
Now, this was a really, really difficult scene because we kept trying to find the original element to go back and print it a little bit.
Wasn't this filmed like as a reflection?
Well, it was filmed as a reflection in folded Mylar. This nice. Shot right here, where it's going in the foreground across, we actually had to stabilize each side of the frame because the left-hand side popped.
Independently of the right.
Right, independently of the right. And in doing so, I was a little concerned because the probe, in order to keep the left and right-hand side stable, the probe in the center would have to be wider. And what we actually realized in doing that was that it was kind of okay because it was in the foreground, whereas before it was just the same size as it was anywhere else in the entire sequence. But because it was in the foreground, it was okay for it to be wider. So it just kind of worked. But this whole sequence, was digitally touched to make it work a little better and be a little bit more
stable. Shooting it in the Mylar and then having to do the optical processing on it, I mean, it got all unstable. And if you were to compare this to what the film originally had, I mean, it just was all over the place in terms of registration. And Darren and I talked about, not that long ago, I don't think, about how the distortion that you do get around the axis of that probe kind of lends itself to what's going on, because you would expect that this thing is so bright, it's so full of energy that...
That its energy field might even be distorting light or, you know, matter
or
around
optical.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is also where we lost one of the security guards in the original assembly of the film.
Right.
That was taken out.
Where did he come
yeah.
from?
And that was that was taken out because at the end of the film, Uhura has to give the casualty list, right? And she has to say, or Kirk does.
Right.
And he has to say Decker, Ilya, and Ensign so-and-so.
Right.
And it's just like, well, who's that? Why do we care? It just took away from the impact that we lost two of our main characters.
And these are some great animation effects by Robert Swarth and his animation team. The moiré pattern that was established for the energy patterns of V'ger.
We were also talking about if we actually did find the original film footage that they used, it probably wouldn't work as well as the distortion for that scene,
right.
with the brightness and how everything looked different, because it's so radically different when you get to
disappearing. I loved this shot where Kirk has the tricorder.
Yeah, it hands it off to Ensign in hand.
Thank you, Thing.
And again, the reason for that distortion and the reason why they shot it in the pellicle or the Mylar sheet was that they basically pressed it to eliminate the gigantic light rig and the operator that was walking around the bridge.
There was one shot even where the elbow of the operator...
There was one shot where you could see the elbow and we removed it.
And there was another shot where I think the shadow underneath the bottom of mm-hmm. it, I think that might still be there, but it goes by so fast.
Which brings up a really funny thing that Darren and I discovered while we were looking through the photos of the models, of what models existed from this film. And we found that probably sold at auction now at Paramount, but we found that light rig still exists in the archive that they walked around the bridge.
That's funny.
I think, when are you going to reuse this thing?
Right. Well, for the next time, V'ger.
That's right. But it was funny that after all these years, it's still there.
Here's Marcy Lafferty, who was Bill Shatner's wife at the time. As Chief DeFalco, replacing Ilya at the Navigator Station. I love this cue by Jerry. With that shot where they first got tractor beamed in, there's a great sampling of the beam, the big long block of wood with strings stretched across it.
When you guys
want
to explain how it really works, bat and everything,
just take a bat and whack it.
It's a giant electric guitar, 18 feet long, and it's this big aluminum box with strings on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
the thing I always found interesting is that...
And you had an artillery shell that you'd hold on the...
Tune it.
Right.
And you'd move it back and forth.
And then somebody hit it with a baseball bat to get the sound.
I loved that John Malcheri had that demoed before we did the sequence from Star Trek, which was great. But I also love the fact that that's it was a very revolutionary idea, and it really makes this score memorable in a similar way that the score for The Day the Earth Stood Still in 1951 by Bernard Herrmann was revolutionary for the theremin, mm-hmm. which was where you passed your hands through the sound wave and it made that kind of sound. Here's a composite of 65 millimeter Enterprise footage with VistaVision V'ger model footage.
I also think this is one of the shots that we color timed to shut off the warp engines.
Right. I don't think, was it that one?
I believe that was one of the mic.
I think we did a couple of them.
You imagine how, I mean, you know, people don't have to deal with labs now when they do effects work. They sit at computers and the computers do their thing.
This is another one.
That one, definitely.
Darren, explain, because...
I actually believe, guys, that it was this shot was the first one, not the previous one. I think the previous one was correct.
That could be.
Well, the point was that...
Kirk orders the engines to be shut down.
Right.
And when, as we saw that when it launched from dry dock, when the...
when the warp engines are off, the deflector dish...
The main drive engines.
He had thrusters
going. At least in this film.
In this film,
God,
yes,
we
that's
sound
right.
Like such geeks.
Well, yeah, that's
no,
what
but,
happens.
But we have to.
But the deflector dish light is colored more gold hued.
It's blue when the impulse, the main drive, and the warp engines are online, and he orders them shut down. So therefore, at that point, it should be gold, not blue.
And it was mostly consistent with that in the film, except for a number of shots where it wasn't accurate. And while we were doing the transfer of the
notice
film,
the 6 points,
we adjusted the color of the deflector dish, which is kind of funny. It's a way of art. We've actually been able to tell if that was same transfer is being used and the high def that's being presented right now, the original version, has the other colored deflector dish from when we did the transfer.
Now that we're inside V'ger, this was again taken over by Trumbull's group. And I believe that this miniature was actually headed up by Greg Jean.
And it looks very similar to some of their work together on Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. And again, it had that six-sided, almost Star of David imagery there. The editor on this film was Todd Ramsey, who I worked with also and interviewed him for a documentary on the making of John Carpenter's The Thing. And he was an apprentice editor on the Hindenburg, which Bob did just prior to this. And then he was given the task of his first feature film to edit, being Star Trek the Motion Picture. And incidentally, first of all, he was part of this endeavor as well and liked everything that we were doing and made some suggestions of his own and was very supportive, and it was great to have him aboard with us.
And he was very, very complimentary of saying, you know, if Bob, anything Bob wants to do.
Right. You know. It made him look better. In fact, one little piece of trivia is that the voice of Starfleet Command after the transporter accident is Todd Ramsey's voice. But
that was not actually intended. It was that they were in such a rush that he threw that in as a temp.
And there it was.
And then when he saw the film,
motion picture,
there was this line there, and he was going, wait a second, how did...
But interesting history around this film is that Bob Wise, for anybody who doesn't know, was the editor of Citizen Kane at the start of his long, illustrious career, which was done for Orson Welles at RKO in 1941. The room was that it was cut in, that he worked in, was at the corner of Melrose Avenue and Gower Street in Hollywood, which is the southwest corner of the Paramount facility now. It was then RKO. And if people won't be bored by some history, that lot, when RKO went under as a movie studio, was purchased by Desilu, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, who had made a fortune on I Love Lucy, and in a brilliant business deal, Desi Arnaz held on to the ownership of the negatives of I Love Lucy, which then became valuable when... television grew and new stations came into the market, and then suddenly the rerun was invented. And then he, in the late 50s, sold the I Love Lucy negatives back to CBS, and with that money he purchased RKO, turned it into Desilu Studios, and it was there that Star Trek was made, and they went into the TV production business with Mission Impossible and the Andy Griffith Show and Danny Thomas and The Untouchables. Lots of shows. That's where Star Trek came to be made and was part of. And then in 1967, Desilu was sold to Gulf and Western, as was Paramount, which coincidentally was the lot next door. So literally they knocked the wall down, and what was RKO and Paramount was now, all became Paramount, 1967, which is how they got Star Trek. So when the movie was made, the film originally in 79 was edited by Todd Ramsey in the very same room that Bob cut Citizen Kane. We unfortunately didn't get to work there when we did the director's edition. We were in a building, the Paul Hager post-production building. It was really fantastic to have Bob coming back to that lot where he got his start. And in fact, the building, which is called, I think it's the Valentino building, was an apartment house when Marathon Street was there. And apartment houses and private homes were there. And Bob's first apartment was in the it was on Marathon Street in the what is now the Valentino building. So it was really a homecoming for him to come back where he to the lot where he first came on in 1938, I think it was, carrying film cans around as an editorial assistant. And then, of course, a little parking lot and billboard company called Viacom eventually grew into becoming a media conglomerate and bought Paramount and CBS. And so now CBS has Star Trek as well as I Love Lucy and other Desilu shows.
I always loved being walking on to the corner of the lot and seeing that they kept the RKO globe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's still there.
That's still up over there.
Very historic area.
I also remember, I think we used this in the docs, but Majel explaining how when they brought Star Trek into to Lucy, she was commenting that Star Trek, and she envisioned that this was a show that they followed stars around, like they were going to have people following her around. So she greenlit the show.
Right.
What a simple little mistake.
Yep. She was the first female head of a TV production facility. Majel was a good friend of hers because she was part of the Desilu Players. So there's a lot of history there, a lot of great Hollywood, old Hollywood history there. And it all led to this film.
That wall behind them we've seen in every other Star Trek incarnation since.
To go back a little bit, we're now dealing with Persis Kambada playing the probe manufactured in the image of Ilia, whom it absorbed. And the sequence where she appears in the sonic shower in what we presume is her own chambers, I guess her own quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a change was made there basically just to the sound, because you had initially the computer voice reading the temperature in the shower. Whereas the point really should have been about the appearance of this, what amounts to a robot, in the image of Ilia. And again, it's like this technology has literally taken over. She's not human, but you know what I mean. Technology has superseded, you know, a physical living being. And that's the danger that this entire crew faces. They have to get past that. They have to conquer that. They have to not let that happen to them.
It's also interesting that the earlier scripts had Ilia as Tasha.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Which I assume was the name that...
There's a lot of riffs in this that were, to coin a phrase, I guess, or term, Roddenberry-isms. This relationship between Decker and Ilia was really redone in the pilot episode of Star Trek The Next Generation 8 years later, Encounter at Farpoint, with Will Riker. Mm-hmm. Even the way that the names that Roddenberry comes up with are similar. And as Dave pointed out, Tasha... wasn't that originally the name for Troy?
And yes.
Did they switch? Okay, yeah. So, I mean, they were all riffs. To a degree, Roddenberry was... this was Roddenberry's vision of Star Trek, this movie, really, more than almost anything else. And he supervised the first season of The Next Generation, and you really saw that influence and what he was going for, to the point where he wanted to use Jerry's theme song, even though Dennis McCarthy, who's a good friend of yours, Dave, right? Mm-hmm. Wrote a theme. But it was rejected and replaced with Jerry's theme.
The electronic hopscotch.
Yes, that's right. Digital hopscotch, used to say.
The one that we were in production, there were so many people who were coming up with this crazy idea that since Enterprise was coming up, that we were going to go back into those pictures on the rec deck and take out
that
the second
Enterprise history
Enterprise
panel and replace
and
it,
put it in
NX-01.
The Enterprise. And they were so sure that was going to happen. And there was never any communication to do it. There was never any plan to do it. I don't think we would have done it had they even asked at the time, because it wasn't necessary.
Now, okay, in addition to Digital Hopscotch, Dave, you also had a name for this game.
Yeah, creating the Fortress of Solitude.
Right. If we had a closer shot of that, you'd see these little crystalline things rising up. Yeah. But
actually, wasn't it you who came up with that one?
Have we broken through technology and maybe made a little... Have we reached the human spirit?
I think she's just realizing that all these games are really boring.
But no, you have
the
to
machine,
play it with four people.
The machine is going to take over. You know, you have to really give credit to her performance in these scenes. She's walking around in something that, if the wind blows the wrong way, you really we would be into R, okay? Not PG. In high heels, okay? And with this tiny little wire around her neck, holding that little red light.
We added the interior V'ger out the window there.
There were lots of angles of that, and there was supposed to be all this activity and stuff going around, which reminded me on the printed page of kind of like the Krell from Forbidden Planet, of all this machinery and stuff moving around. Again, it was like originally supposed to be much, much more elaborate, and there's a great artist named Robert McCall who was brought in to design a lot of concepts for the interior V'ger and what all that technology was doing.
Right, particularly for the Spock walk later on.
Mm-hmm. And for the climax.
Right.
And that went back, actually, to when it was a TV pilot,
what
right?
What a gorgeous shot.
There's the... Dave is giving me the motion here. It's Jerry doing
The windshield wiper.
The Enterprise windshield wipers. Now, we had a lot of fun when we did this project, and again, we mentioned the continuity of Enterprise. We joked in some lighter moments about doing our own bit of continuity, and one joke was to replace this guy with Mr. Arix from Star Trek The Animated Series.
I thought that would have been a great idea, but...
But here, I love this when they go out of frame, you wonder, what are they doing?
Why is Spock going down there?
What's he doing there?
Maybe he held that a little bit long. Again... Focus on the people, the relationships. This scene was edited with Bob together from two different versions of the scene that had seen previously. And again, that physical connection, here's something touching something else. That's a motif that just goes all through this film. She eventually takes it off. She doesn't want that connection.
Didn't we kind of picture the Spock walk as Spock on Ice, the music?
No, it was the cloud. You always said that about the cloud cue. Spock on Ice. The cue called the cloud.
Just evoked a different image.
Again, there's some reaction shots here, like that one of Majel, really good, and that one of McCoy. That wasn't in the original. It stayed on a wide shot. And as this process evolved, Bob really saw, no, we needed the people. We needed to focus on the people.
I don't recall seeing that headgear in the Christie's auction.
Wonder where it went.
Sinead O'Connor keeps it.
Probably.
But it's an awfully...
Again, all
mechanism.
Those wonderful percussion implements that Jerry put in here, the water phones. And,
right. One that sounds like a rusty gate.
Yes, uh-huh. It's the Super Bowl, I think, is in here. And, of course, the beam... is always with anything to do with the V'ger and the Ilia probe is there.
I really miss Jerry. Miss
great
his scores.
Man.
He was
really
amazingly
great.
Inventive.
And there's also anything to do with Spock has that distant native percussion. I highly doubt that Jerry sat and watched episodes of the old series. But somehow or other, he got that. He got that Spock came from an ancient civilization that probably had some violence in its past. So you hear, like, just it could be an innocuous thing like Spock sitting at his station talking.
But it's like echoes of
this,
violence.
Primitive drums in somewhere in the distant past. We took out here the
instructions.
Thruster suit audio instruction manual. We figured that, of all people, Spock would know how to run one. And again, it was that we stop to deal with technology so much in this original script. And it was a very cool idea at the time. But when Bob looked at this film, he saw that that was wrong. And if he had previewed it in 1979, he would have seen that that was wrong. That the technology is V'ger, the people are dealing with each other, our main family of characters, it has to be focused on their relationships and what's going on in their own minds. I think this is also, as I said earlier, this is probably the only science fiction movie about going out into space that's actually about going inside things.
Right.
And again, that what it's about is we're getting inside your own mind. We're going to inside the human psyche here, and these people are going to have to get inside their own brains and figure out what is wrong with them. And really what is wrong with them is that they need each other.
This is the beginning of the Spock walk sequence that was originally going to be quite different in the original script, and they had shot some of it when Kirk and Spock were originally going to go out together and explore the interior of V'ger.
The memory wall.
As a quick point before you continue, Darren,
mention this change is coming.
Is that again to heighten the jeopardy that people felt in the picture? This orifice opens, and it used to just sit there as Spock goes through. And one of the last changes that our team were able to get was to have it close just right behind him.
Right. It obviously needed to be there. It obviously was a still photo in the beginning, in the original version. It needed to be there. It was one of those things that they just had to let go. Now. Again, it's like Spock is going on this incredible odyssey. It is very evocative of 2001. Again, this is a lot of Trumbull influence here because he's the one that came in and suggested that, you know what, this memory wall sequence doesn't work. It's boring. It's dull. It's not engaging in any way.
Trumbull actually was brought on at around the time that they were actually shooting the memory wall sequence.
Right.
And Trumbull was realizing that this isn't going to work. Even you have a marvelous set and interesting things, but in the end, it's going to look like two guys hanging on wires.
And right. There was nowhere for them to really go, and no other way to shoot it because it was designed so two-dimensionally
one angle, yeah.
That there was only one angle to shoot the whole thing in.
But again, he employed this fantastic concept of first-person cinema.
I mean, look at this. Look at this sequence. Prior to computers. That you could film
it's astounding.
An amazing sequence that looks like this.
And it makes my head ache thinking about the optical work that they had to wait through all the lab work to get and see what they had.
Yeah. A lot of this work is actually Robert McCall illustrations that were put on the animation stand.
That's right.
Like this one. Actually, the center, the space lips, as it was called, was an actual physical model that they made.
And didn't we find that too?
Yes, we found that.
It also, shall I say, has some sexual overtones to it.
And there's the often comment about it being Miss Piggy noticeable in there, and it's not.
Or Darth Vader, all kinds of...
It was just coincidental.
It just shows you how abstract images will let people see what they want to see.
But you see, this is, on the surface, about Spock going inside V'ger and finding out what's in there. But this is actually a journey into his own mind to figure out what's going on with him. And once in there, he realizes that subconsciously, now it's going to be externalized, what's missing, what he needs to do is to make this touch. So he's going to reach out and touch this sensor that represents V'ger. And what happens? He doesn't want to connect it. He backs away. He's thrown away from it.
And interestingly, Ilea, being the most arguably passionate character,
right.
Even though Starfleet has forced her to not be.
But you see, that's why that scene where she heals Chekhov is so important.
Right. It's this, the most passionate character being combined with the most dispassionate being, of V'ger, makes an interesting combination, and it's very full of symbolism.
And once again, it's like you could very easily scan for somebody coming through that orifice and then beaming them in. And that might have been practical, but I mean, this idea of Kirk getting in and going into this vacuum chamber after his friend, I mean, that's what Star Trek is all about. And that it was those kind of moments that you needed to find everyone you could and play them up.
The other problem with that sequence was the that was one of the reasons why Bob didn't like the special longer version, is that they originally had this extended sequence of Kirk leaving the Enterprise before going to see Spock, which again just lengthened the whole sequence of him going into this spacesuit. I have to go out and I have to get him, and he goes
the
outside,
idea of him and you see him going was good,
right? You see him leaving the ship, then only for Spock to show up, but the spacesuit that he was wearing was from the memory wall sequence.
Right, it didn't match.
So it's like while he's out in space, he would have had to have changed suits, so it didn't match for continuity.
Not to mention that they put in as part of that scene on television and on videotape, the plate for what needed to have a matte painting of the Enterprise saucer around it that was never done. So
and it's funny, for the scenes that we transferred that and put that on the second disc, you can see all the scaffolds.
Right, you saw the people walking into the commissary practically. Yeah.
And the reason that they changed the design of the spaceships was so that we could see the reflection of all this happening around Spock on Spock's, when we're still looking at Spock's face.
I remember that... you and I, Darren, were talking about completing the mat on the shot.
That that mat shot of Kirk coming out of
right,
and leaking
and leaking it out as here's one of the additional shots from the director's edition. But we realized that would have been. It would have been something that could have really backfired instead of something that would have been fun. It could have been something that can say, well, these guys, you know, the people who are putting this thing together don't realize that he's wearing the wrong spacesuit, or that it would get the expectations to be that, oh, the memory wall is going to be back. And there was never a plan for the memory wall to be back. It didn't work. It wasn't going back. But we just didn't feel that was, you know, while it was a fun idea, and I know you rendered it.
Right there. They're one of the most important moments in this film and in all of Star Trek, where Spock says, I was wrong. I should have known. I was looking for logic and unemotion. But do you know what? I was wrong. This is what it's all about. Just brilliant, simple scene. We took out also another incident of Kirk snapping, biting McCoy's head off there. And of stating the obvious, you know, Kirk had a line there, what questions? Well, it was better to have Spock just continue his monologue. And the tail of this scene had him summarizing
right.
A machine planet, sending a machine to Earth looking for its creator, you know, and it, again, to make sure that the audience understood what was going on. But when we viewed this with Bob, he says, don't we know that already?
Mm-hmm.
I said, do you think so? He says, yes, take it out.
More great examples of the split diopter.
Yes.
Yeah, which allows you to have two focal planes in one shot on a widescreen image like this. And it was necessary because of how cramped it was on the sets.
Here's our first look at the full exterior of V'ger. And this was done by... started on by Steve Berg at Foundation at the time, and he did a lot of research and found Sid Mead's designs for V'ger, and I think really nailed it, and John Teska took over the shots of it later on.
That was the one shot. I mean, that was the shot that we needed in this film. We looked at many, many, many different passes of it, right? That was, if there was one that we obsessed over, mm-hmm. it was probably that.
Yeah, that
to
was
get
the
it,
one that had the
it
most
just, right.
Too much smoke, not enough smoke,
the movement, where the Earth is, I mean, everything,
small,
it had to sell. And when we premiered this at the Paramount Theater on the lot, everybody applauded. And so I think we did what we set out to do. But they didn't have that originally, and you never really understood the geography of what was going on, that the cloud had dissipated, revealing this enormous vessel orbiting Earth. You get a graphic there that represents it, which always reminded me kind of the RKO logo from the old films, a lot of which Bob Wise made. And what they ended up with was just cutting some shots, repeating some shots from other portions of the movie.
This was another sequence where sound was going to play a major role. We were talking, you know, Bob was saying that part of the other reason that the, in watching the film is that it wasn't, Vija wasn't as threatening. And we needed to present this powerful threat in sound as much as in picture. And so when we were dealing with this, I said to Chuck, really make it feel like this remarkable, powerful energy comes from way behind you and goes right over the
Well, Spock
the
even says that those balls of energy are hundreds of times more powerful than what attacked the ships.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to get that sense. Plus, do you remember we found fully executed color paintings of those exact angles of V'ger, which they had filmed for the purpose of cutting into the picture for a preview that never happened. So all we did was create those exact angles, exactly as they were painted and planned.
What's funny is that the only shot that we pretty much did for the film that wasn't used was a shot of the balls over the Earth going into position.
Right, it was the entire Earth surrounded by these energy weapons.
We actually, a few years ago, gave the shot to StarTrek.com. So they have the, you'll be able to see that shot if you go on online, and you should be able to see that.
I think there are also alternate versions of the
rack focus version.
Right, the Enterprise reflection in the travel pod window. Mm-hmm. So now, I think the end result, which really, the rhythm and the feeling of the movie has not changed at all. But what has happened is that you now understand exactly what's going on, and that is what Bob was going for, what he inspired in us. You know, we sat and watched the picture several times with him and made all of our notes about what he wanted and to see what we could do. And then he basically let us do it and looked at everything. And he did have some opinions where he told us put it back the way it was, or ideas of his own, or to change things. But again, the goal was to not make you suddenly feel like you are seeing a different movie than you remember seeing. And I'm sorry to say that that fate has befallen a number of science fiction films from this era. That we don't need to specifically name at the moment. You probably know what they are. But in the case of all of them, they were all hugely successful films and didn't need to really be messed with at all. But nobody was standing on a pedestal rallying for the cause of the 1979 version of this movie. It was very, very obvious that it was unfinished, that the raw material was all there. It simply needed the normal amount of time, the normal amount of work that every film usually gets and always deserves.
The greatest compliment that I feel that we've received from this picture is when people say that they've seen the film and they didn't really notice anything different.
Mm-hmm. And that's...
I don't want people to say, oh, I love that one shot, it was great. That means we failed or didn't, you know... When it's so seamless that you don't know that there are a thousand edits in this project. Sometimes we had to pull one frame.
And I think over 90 shots that were in some way altered in terms of effects.
Right? Over 100.
Right.
That when you do that much work and no one notices it, it's that's the compliment I want. That's what means you did your job. Instead of the constant reviews of, oh, did you see that great new whatever? No, that's not the way it works.
This was a moment where I specifically remember being on the mixing stage with Chuck Michael and doing this scene, this reel
that
day.
Such a great job.
And I'm like, wow, this whole thing has just come to life, and I just feel like we're all going to be blown to smithereens any second. Yeah.
And it's good to hear the feedback of people who have given this movie a second look and you know, looked at it 20 years later and said, you know, this is better than I remembered it, and I really understand it now, mm-hmm. or I really mm-hmm. enjoy it a lot more than I did when
I
was younger.
But I can't tell you what's different.
Right.
Now, also,
or, you know, I don't remember it being as good as it was.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned earlier about the sound work, the sound design, particularly for the bridge. which we built too gradually. When you first got, so everybody scrambling around trying to get the thing going, it was almost no noise. When it was the scene where Ilea comes on, there was a few things going. And then when they got underway, you had the full level of sound. And now here, where Kirk gives the order to shut everything down and put everything on automatic, we gradually dropped the sound of the bridge out. So you have this contrast, whereas in the original version, you didn't have that at all. It was always the same. It was this kind of low hiss of room tone, and that was it.
I always, it gives us someplace to go, sound-wise, audibly.
Mm-hmm. And you see that everything is off behind her. I think we kept in a very quiet beep of an automated system working. And then as they come back onto the bridge and resume their stations, you gradually can now hear them all coming on. People press buttons and something happens. Even though in reality, you know, we all use computers now. We don't have a beep for every button we press. Nothing beeps.
I do.
You do? Well, Darren, that's you. That's why you did this thing.
Right.
Because you knew that, so. But you see, you're watching, you know, it's like why every time you look at somebody asleep in a movie or a TV show, they're snoring. Why? Because you visually understand that they're sleeping, they're not dead. So that's why you need the beeps when you hit panels in science fiction movies.
It's funny, the other interesting comment that I remember from one of the reviews when Director's Edition came out was that they even made the uniforms better. And I was stopped and I started thinking, what does this person mean? And it just, what I think it was that without any sound on the bridge, as dead as it was, it left you just looking around for something to, you know, experience. And there was so many shots of just people standing around that were tightened.
Here's our big overhaul of the last act, where we go into the inner chamber that Spock has been in before. But now we see, I guess, all the imagery is turned off, and we see its actual interior. And this was intended to show things in there before, and we had boards for it, and we had to do a little bit of design work to flesh out what hadn't actually been created for it. But I think it's a nice bridging in between the final confrontation at the island to this transference into the inner chamber.
There was an earlier version that we were talking about early on with Bob that we just ended up going with this and loved this. This is the final result. That the orifice opens and it was going to be space. It looked like it was space, almost like you were going into that secondary section and everything was still on. And then when you finally pull through there, it's almost like they were either being released or being put into that extra section. And when they pull closer, the stars that were out there were going to start moving, and they would start building, they would come out to be the blocks that would build the bridge. It was just something that was early on that we were discussing with Bob of an idea, and I always really liked the idea of the illusion that they were going into this next space.
Right.
And, or into some new hologram.
I think going with what the storyboards were, I think was the way to go, even though there were many versions of that. That had, again, later on you'll see these lightning bolts that are coming around where the Enterprise ultimately comes to rest. And one idea was that those bolts would illuminate all this massive machinery of this chamber, but it felt bigger keeping it black. This sequence was put back in, very important one. Two very important things happen here. One is Kirk ordering the self-destruct to be on standby in case they fail, to take V'ger with them. And the other was the Spock weeping scene, which was improvised into the script by Leonard Nimoy, actually, because he realized that, again, the main theme, what this story really was about, was not on paper, and it needed to be stated. It needed to be in there. So we track around the bridge here to, you know, each of our characters, and then finally end up on Spock, and then get this extraordinary moment where Spock weeps and he explains really what's going on in the film. I loved a little bit earlier also, while Kirk was ordering the self-destruct, the exchange of glances between him and Steve Collins as Decker. Their relationship, you know, the rift has been repaired there. Nothing specifically happened to bring that about, but it's probably just Spock's presence that again, that gradual build up of this camaraderie and working together and all finding their destiny once again. They become themselves again.
Right, and they're all settling into their purpose.
Even though they're facing death right in the face.
Right.
You know, they're becoming complete people again.
It was all of them coming together like they originally did.
Right.
Which launched the movie series.
Right. Because we got things back to where they needed to be. Kirk and crew on the Enterprise.
And made us want to see more.
But I think the insert also that was added of the Enterprise going through the innards, that passageway into this chamber that they're getting towards now, was put in right at the spot where it needed to be, because right where Scotty said, yes, V'ger, we'll take V'ger with us, we now actually see that they're in the midst of this vessel and the matter-antimatter explosion is just going to take it all with it.
I love that something we haven't actually said yet is that shot, which I believe Steve Berg designed, was mm-hmm. that right? When we were cutting this film, the way that the film looked and the fact that it's an epic picture, the way your eye registers something when it's big versus a video screen is very different. So we had set up a projector at Paramount to our editing system when we were editing with the entire film on the wall, to make sure that scale was not going to be betrayed as we were doing it and the timing would not be betrayed for the epic film. And what I really love about that shot of the Enterprise going through the inner operings of V'ger is that nowadays you'd have a much bigger shot of the ship, but that stayed with the massive scale.
Because at the scale we were looking at it, we could see it.
Right, and pulling back still kept it the epic scale of the entire picture, even though that was a completely new shot.
This was great. I mean, Bob Wise's collection is at USC and at the Cima Television Library, run by our friend Ned Comstock. And when we first were talking about this and went down there and looked through all of this and found the storyboards for this wing walk sequence, as it was officially called, we were astounded, because in the 79 version, it looks like they just sort of pull up to a soundstage, right, mm-hmm. and yeah. stop, and you actually hear a clunk of them pulling up. And then they just kind of get out there, and in some very hastily executed matte paintings, do this walk across these hexagonal tiles. But now, based on original storyboards, you see V'ger's brain complex island sort of floating there with the sort of Stonehenge-like structures coming up out of it. And you see V'ger forming these hexagonal blocks as a bridge to the Enterprise. All done based on the original storyboards in CG, including the little people coming up through the hatch there and getting into the position that they need to be in for the live-action shots. And then we have shots of them walking across that we went back to the original blue screen plates, correct?
Yes, mm-hmm. and those
the
little
angle shots.
Those little right. lights that come in, we actually animated on twos so that it would look like it was shot on an animation stand, and we didn't put any motion blur in it, we didn't put anything like that, just to make it look like a shot that was done in 79.
Right. right. And then I also believe that we had, was it these lightning bolts, were they done with a Tesla coil?
Or well, they were originally done with a Tesla coil, then weren't they scanned well, from the I'm original saying, film yeah, that right. we found, Mark, right. Darren?
I'm saying we found the original film that of these lightning bolts. These weren't just animated things put
these
in.
These were not recreated. You know,
these were the actual lightning bolts done in 78, 79, yeah. and then when we needed to recomposite them into the film. You're looking at the original lightning. See, and this is what it becomes all about, this entire journey across space and through this cloud and into this vessel. And what does it come down to? It comes, down to this tiny little thing with a wire that's not connected. And see right there, that lightning behind there was not there originally. It was put
I think
in.
A lot of modern-day game shows owe a lot to the design of this set.
I would say so. Mm-hmm. You are the weakest link. There again, that lightning was put in. So you'd never notice it. You'd never know it. I mean, it just You'd have to compare the two versions of the film frame by frame, but those little things...
Which we've done.
we three have, yes. But this was a treacherous set. People kept falling through it. And there you have Ilea and V'ger. Decker seeing the two of them. Can I tell them apart or can I not? Is this really the woman I once loved or is this part of this machine? And of course it has to be Kirk, has to be Captain Kirk, you know, who has taken this entire journey up to a couple of letters that are scarred over. And that has led to that question of who am I? You know, what is my role in the universe? And that's what all these characters are asking themselves. Harold Livingston, the screenwriter of this, very witty, acerbic guy. I'm sure he would love to have had the time to flesh that concept out some more. Whether it really would have happened is another story, but it's there. That's where really the movie that's inside all of us is, you know, finding out what part of you is covered with dirt that you can't see, that you need to reveal to figure out who you are. Jerry Goldsmith's son, Joel Goldsmith, who is a composer himself and wrote a lot of the Borg-related cues for Star Trek First Contact, did the what essentially is this voice of V'ger. And right there, I think it was telling us that the coffee was ready. But again, a very interesting sound. It's mechanical, yet it's organic. It's not altogether different in concept from R2-D2 and the Star Wars sound designer's Ben Burtt's efforts to have that combination of organic and technological together where you can't really tell where one began, one ended.
Well, it's interesting that the kinetic lighting that's underneath the set that you can see showing the coalescing patterns of light.
That's in using engineering,
too. Was also used in engineering, and they brought back that the people who did that for Voyager for their engine room as well.
With a bit more color. As a matter of fact, it was the same exact device, wasn't it, Darren?
I believe
that they actually recycled the motion picture one?
I think so.
And also, I mean, that was like the first time this movie was where we saw an actual warp engine core. It with this became standard on Star Trek every time we saw a starship.
Actually,
and basically, the engineering core, the warp core was basically in the same spot, right?
It was the same
That's
spot,
the same,
using
yeah.
a lot of the same set pieces,
for
just
every,
rearranged.
Every incarnation of Star Trek.
Since this movie, up until the end of Enterprise, those sets were all used for Star Trek since, you know, 20-some-odd years. That in the interim, that was always a Star Trek project.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the lighting changes here, you know, as V'ger comes closer to realizing what it needs. We go a little bit warmer here, a little bit while we're going to go into a magenta, and then finally into a complete red. It's pure classic science fiction. The kind of set they're in, the sound work, the way the lighting changes, the music cue that Jerry's humming away with. Under this thing, this is classic science fiction, and Bob was really good at this. He did every genre well, but you know, when you just look at the three sci-fi movies he did, Day the Earth Stood Still, and The Andromeda Strain, and this, there's that simplicity and that sense of never straying too far from really what the conventions of the genre are, and doing it really well in an almost definitive way. Dare I say?
And Gene was a very big fan of Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes.
So he was totally honored and thrilled to have Bob do this picture.
See, and Bob, very talented guy, but not a really emotional guy. In a way, he was a lot like Spock. And his movies are not full of gushing. There's never any really Never even any gushing romantic things in almost any film that he did. Even West Side Story, The Sound of Music, his musicals, it was always restrained. He backed off on that as much as possible and just told the story. So it's interesting that in this movie, they're all so detached. And for me, that idea that they need to come together, they need to share emotions with each other, comes through, but it comes through in a very Robert Wise kind of way. See, and there you come to what it's all about. It's not about just give me some numbers, right? Star Trek was never about just give me the numbers. It's about who we are, who we're connecting with, who we are as people.
Bob's such a master when it comes to just her stepping forward with...
Yes, uh-huh.
It's... With, you know, Creator Must Want to Join with VG, you just feel it.
She senses who among this group is also incomplete right now. You see, Decker has had his ship taken away. He's had his former love come into his life and then...
Taken away
and turned into a machine. You know, what is his destiny? Kirk and Spock and McCoy all belong with each other. They belong on the Enterprise.
And here's the physical symbol of broken connection.
Right.
Yes, don't touch it, Captain.
You'll get a shock. See, and this idea of they can't figure out a problem unless they're all part of it. They each have something to bring to the table. Kirk has his input, Spock has his, McCoy has his, and together, you know, it's often been, I think, said in analysis of Star Trek is that really McCoy and Spock were two sides of Kirk's psyche.
Right.
One was the logic, the other one was the emotion. And he would always sit back and listen to see, to listen to the two debate with each other and then work out, find some middle ground and work out the problem. In a way that wasn't reckless, nor was it cold. And that's what he does here.
Now we've entered into the red phase.
Remember this on video cassette? Just man, all it, red, it bleeding
was,
everywhere?
It looked frightening.
Yeah, I think video level standards have improved as technology has. We can now get a picture that's has much more latitude and can show us much more accurate to what a film originally looked like and what the artist originally went for. Now Kirk puts it together. See, he's listened to Spock and McCoy, and now he's put it together.
Well, I think this was one of the key parts of the script phase that Nimoy and Shatner contributed the most to, this
yes.
final solution.
I really love this moment here where Ilia pushes Kirk away.
Good timing. With
See,
the light
and then
too.
look at Steven's reaction. He looked up. You know, it's like he knows that she knows mm-hmm. that this is right, that this is what needs to happen. This is really an amazing concept. This is, you know, this movie essentially was 2001: A Space Odyssey with the Star Trek cast.
Yes.
And I think there was a lot of people don't give it enough credit because can you take a very campy, very inexpensively done TV series from the 1960s that really was considered a failure? And do those characters and that concept, can they hold their own in a science fiction story of the weight and importance of 2001: A Space Odyssey? And
right. Will they stand up on that canvas?
Right. And it does. And, this is an incredible concept of an intelligent machine that basically, you know, as Spock says, its knowledge spans the universe. If you really study that phrase, you know, spans the universe, it's just mind-boggling. But yet it can do nothing without a soul, basically.
Well, it's a theme that's inspired a tremendous amount of sci-fi as well. Mm-hmm.
But it's an essential human myth, right? It's like
it's, It's amazing how powerful and beautiful the sequence is.
And what is Jerry writing here musically? He's writing a big lovemaking scene.
Totally.
You know?
And this is like the, you know,
if you listen to just the music,
two parts of a baby.
It's a romantic melody builds literally to, you know, a climax. You're actually standing there watching a new form of life, you know.
Guys, I think it's time to leave.
Yes, and they've been in this situation before. You get that sense that now you kind of needed this journey. Now it's Star Trek. Now it's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy having figured out the problem and getting their ass out of there, back to their ship. And, this problem solved. What's next?
We added one shot in this, using the original animation moiré patterns.
Right. Again, to be very clear with the geography, because abstract works to a degree, but at this point in the film, right at the climax, right there, you have to understand what's going on. And that physical existence of that vast vessel no longer matters. Vedir has evolved into this incredible consciousness that can't be contained anymore. And it goes off into its own plane of existence, you know, revealing the Enterprise, which is a microcosm in itself. It's a whole universe in and of itself, with now a family of characters who have figured out that they need each other and that they all belong right where they are. I mean, to people who love Star Trek, you face a lot of opposition to this film and not understanding what's going on. And yeah, it has some clunkiness to it, quite a bit of it. We worked with Bob Wise to smooth over as much of it as we possibly could, but that, to me, it's still there. That concept is still there. It's essential Star Trek, I would argue.
And this is talking about what we've just been through and the central core of the story, but it's also talking about Star Trek itself. It's the rebirth into a new form of Star Trek.
Again, another director might have gone very weepy with the moment where Scotty comes in and says, we can get you back to Vulcan. But, you know, Bob, in his own very clinical way, knows that it's enough to simply have Spock say, my task on Vulcan is completed. Therefore, he doesn't belong back on Vulcan, seeking total logic, out in a Vulcan monastery in the desert with his hair growing long. He belongs here. Nice theatrical moment, again, also of bringing the few missing people back onto the bridge. There, Majel is Dr. Chapel and Scotty. And then right there, Kirk with Spock and McCoy standing behind him loyally. That's Star Trek. And again, that ending. It's like, it's not about, 457 Mark 329, whatever. It's just that away. It's about us. It's about the people. It's about we're going exploring. It's not about the technology, the machines. Those are our tools. That's what's going to get us there. We've gotten there because we've all worked together to get here. There's a lot of people, particularly politicians, who really should watch this movie, maybe even listen to our humble commentary and figure that out. Figure out, you know, that we need to connect. And then maybe if we do, we can get to what we're seeing right here.
And we close it off with the stars as we began it.
And of course, that sums it all up right there.
At least not the pop that originally had on there. The last shot of the Enterprise going into warp, Doug Trumbull was telling us, was the bookending of the original shot that Dykstra did with the Klingons.
Right.
That John did that shot on his own with his group,
And when Doug saw it, he was like, okay, well, you're going to do that. Where, you know, I need something. I'm going to do something in the end with the Enterprise. And the fun little camaraderie, but the amazing results that came up there gave us two of the greatest shots that have been in any science fiction picture.
And it's funny, very early on here, when I was making my model of the movie Enterprise, I, of course, wanted to do, you know, shots from the movie to see if it worked. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the first thing I did was try and recreate that ending shot of the Enterprise and light it correctly and do all the wonderful things. And when we went to see Doug Trumbull, I showed it to him on my PowerBook, and he said,
blown away.
Wow, that's it. And that was really cool, and I'll never forget that.
It reminds me here, looking at the credits, that Alan Howarth was listed in here, and he was one of the guy who did Aaliyah's
processing on her voice.
And it was funny because we had basically one line, which is carbon units are not true life forms, right. Only the creator with and other similar life forms are true, that we needed recreated the same way. And our team just said, you know, it's such a difficult thing to get, let's go back to Alan Howarth. And we did, and he delivered four or five different versions of it. And it's just funny that that we'd end up going back.
He's a terrific electronic music specialist and well known for working with John Carpenter on his scores.
Yeah, Sid Mead's name in the original credits had an extra E on the end, and we fixed it.
Well, a few little things were fixed, even in the credits. But there's, of course, a lot of people at Paramount who worked at the time and also when we did this project who deserve our gratitude for facilitating it. As we talked about earlier, we'd like to finish it, but particularly the people that managed the film, Waltz. They were just fantastic.
I want to mention a few.
And
we had
Laura Thornburg.
Jeff Rodoysis was in charge, and we had Laura and we had Ron Smith.
Right.
And it was just, we couldn't have asked for a better group of people working with us to get this thing done.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a thrilling experience for Bob to be able to go back and finish it. It was always for him, it was like the one that got away. And, you know, he had always talked about it was the only film that he had never previewed of 39 films. He then... his 40th was a Showtime film called A Storm in Summer, and then following that, he came back with us to Paramount and to finish Star Trek. And we mentioned the premiere that we had at the lot. That was extraordinarily gratifying to see him really, truly happy with the film, audience applauding it. The Hollywood Bowl performance we also mentioned was extraordinarily gratifying.
While we're on their names, let's mention the folks at Foundation Imaging here who did an amazing job with a very difficult job in a short amount of time. And of course, John O. and Ben Martin, who helped Chuck with the sound.
Right.
And amazing job all around.
And even to today, you know, I couldn't have imagined two guys that I wouldn't...
Thank you, Dave.
Could have done a better job with this. It's an honor working with you guys.
And that's our audio commentary for Star Trek The Motion Picture, The Director's Edition. Thanks for joining us. Please visit StarTrek.com for more exclusive features.